This is Karen Tanner. Today's date is June 18, 1973. The time is 1 p.m. I will be interviewing Reverend O.J. Eckert of Saginaw, Michigan. Topics to be discussed are the early organization of St. Paul's Lutheran Church, the occupation of its members, the difference between the old Michigan Synod and the present Michigan Synod, the reason for St. Paul's School, the start of the Lutheran Seminary in Saginaw, the separation from the Wisconsin Synod.
Of pastors and congregations in the state of Michigan.
That
constituted the old Michigan Synod. Now, that one book I showed you is entirely a history of the old Michigan Synod. Maybe I should go down and get that again.
What's the difference between the old Michigan Synod and the Michigan Synod of today?
The difference, there is Michigan Synod anymore. That Michigan Synod has turned out to be the Michigan District of the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. They have become a district of the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod.
Oh, I see.
But the old Michigan Synod was at first sort of an independent group. And it was founded I don't know if you want to get the date of finding.
Well, they were, the old Michigan Synod was independent from 1896 to 1909.
Yes, from 1896 to 1909, and before that they were connected with the General Council, I think.
Was there, that was a separation away from the Wisconsin Synod, is that correct?
Well, there was no Wisconsin Synod at that time. There were Lutherans in various states in the Midwest. Like, for instance, there were some in Michigan, some in Wisconsin, Minnesota. Mainly it was Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota that had these independent synods. Now, some of them were connected with the General Council. I think I have that in that booklet there, haven't I?
The General Council.
Which was a body that had its headquarters in the East. And there was very lax practice in some of these congregations. The General Council did have a very lax practice, and some of these congregations were influenced by that lax practice. And as a result of that, I think I bring that out in the booklet, they had a meeting in Monroe, mm-hmm. where the questions, doctrinal questions and practical questions came up. For instance, the position against the lodge.
Oh, yes.
You noticed that.
Masonic Lodge,
and then other lodges. And then the what they call unionism being practiced, that they didn't stay separate from the other churches, like they fellowshiped with Episcopalians or Baptists, which mm-hmm. was against the practice of the conservative, sound conservative Lutherans. And as a result of that, I think I bring it out in the year, what year they finally separated after a meeting of here, this is the fact that the General Council took no definite stand by always leaving a back door open to a violation of those principles mentioned, namely that we take a stand against Hilliism, and that we do not practice open communion, and that we do not practice pulpit fellowship with another persuasion, and that we reject secret societies and their spirit and essence as in conflict with the spirit of true Christianity. Now, those were the four principles on which the old Michigan Synod separated, and that's what's brought out here, the fact that the General Council took no definite stand by always leaving a back door open to a violation of these principles resulted in no delegation from the old Michigan Synod being sent to the convention of 1887. And to make a long story short, in the eventual joining of the old Michigan Synod with a conservative body, the Wisconsin Synod. But they separated and existed before they joined the Wisconsin Synod. The old Michigan Synod existed independently. Well, you have the date down there, I guess.
1896 to 1909.
Yes. As a result of this difference there, they did separate from the General Council, and then they remained a separate synod from 1896 to 1909. But then there were movements afoot to organize a conservative larger body in various districts. Now, in the year 1909, the Michigan Senate, the Wisconsin Senate, the state in the state of Wisconsin, and the Minnesota group, they formed what we call today the, well, then it was known as the Wisconsin Senate, now it's called the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Senate. And that was the beginning of the Michigan Synod becoming a part of the larger body.
Oh, I see.
And I would say, historically, it would mean that it was the end of the old, what we always called the old Michigan Synod.
I see.
Now, the old Michigan Synod today would be represented in what we call the congregations in the Michigan District of the Wisconsin Synod. They would be the old Michigan Synod. Of course, they've grown considerably. But this is all there was in the old Michigan Synod. This booklet was put out. I hope they put a date down here. It's funny how they...
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't.
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But I would say this booklet was written about 1909 or... somewhere in there, because I don't think that when this booklet was written, now here's the General Council, it's connection with the General Council is gone into, and it's quite extensive. But what it says here, in the year, I'll just read it, not in German, I mean.
Okay.
Therefore, President Eberhardt recommended in the year 1888, we should now openly declare our position over against the General Council. This was in 1888, through a declaration of separation from this body. As long as this does not take place, we will always be considered to be un-Lutheran by positive Lutherans, and rightly so. This recommendation was followed by the Synod Now, this is the old Michigan Senate, followed by the old Michigan Senate, just says Senate here, but it was here. Following resolutions, A, we deplore the fact that we cannot any longer feel at home in the General Council and connected with them in the unity of the Spirit. Since we cannot recognize in this body a sincere effort to uphold Lutheran doctrine and practice, and our earnest testimony against this un-Lutheran carrying on, especially against pulpit fellowship with non-Lutherans, we see that this testimony of ours against this has not borne any fruit. That's A, that they deplore for the reasons mentioned. This is rough translation. B, the reason why they separated in 1888. The position of the General Council over against our pastors forces us, for conscience reason, to declare our separation from this church body. It's number C, point three. May God grant the Honorable General Council the grace to acknowledge that we as a Lutheran Synod could not act otherwise on the basis of our confession. D. May the time soon come for the General Council that it take these things seriously on the basis of principles which they themselves have accepted, but of course which they rejected. Now, those are the resolutions that were passed in 1888, and then the Michigan Synod separated from the General Council. So this connection, this which had consisted for, which had been in force for 24 years, was dissolved. Not hastily or without deliberation, but because of good reasons, in order that the correct Lutheran practice may be carried out. Now, let's see, I'm going to skip some things here. Now, these resolutions were passed by the old Michigan Synod in the year 1888. Now, what are your dates there?
1896.
Now, it must have taken a period of time for the dissolution following these resolutions to completely effective.
I would assume so.
See, these were passed in the Synod of 1888, the Michigan Synod's meeting in 1888. This simply says that Eberhardt recommended, the president recommended in 1888, that we should make our position clear. And then these ABCs that I read followed. And
is this Pastor Eberhardt, is he the same minister that was at St. Paul's?
Yes, that's the same pastor that was at St. Paul's.
He spoke for the location of the Michigan Lutheran Seminary in Saginaw. And for this purpose, he donated 2.5 acres of land, and the congregation pledged $1,000. Considering the poorness of the congregation at this time, how did they acquire such a large parcel of land? Was there a government in there some
no.
way where they?
No, there was no government help in any way. $1,000 today isn't anything.
But then it
but
was
then
quite
it was
a sum of money.
But
wasn't his wife's family
rather
well-to-do? Would that be how he would acquire
that,
the acreage?
Yes, Eberhardt must have had money that he could use for that purpose. Now, if you go off to Oakwood Cemetery, you'll see that he has a, what would you call it, quite a monument where he's buried.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good darn. In the early years of St. Paul's Church, what was the most prevalent occupation of its members?
Well, I think that the members of St. Paul's no doubt followed the general trend at that time to be occupied in the lumbering.
Lumbering?
You know, they had, there was a salt industry in Saginaw,
mm-hmm.
too, and then they also, the sugar factory in Carlton, that was quite a thing that's still going.
I found the early history of St. Paul's very, very interesting. And I noticed that in the first 10 years, there were 8 changes in the pastorate. Is there any specific reason why there's so many changes?
Well, the reason for that, I think, is because things were so unsettled. That when you look at the early history of St. Paul's, they were a small group.
Very small.
And for a while, they were connected with St. John's on 2nd and Federal. And the conditions were very unstable.
There was a split at the time in St. Paul's because of them being on the west side and people from the east side across the river wanting to come to church, and then they ended up separating because they had trouble getting their families across the river.
That's right. They were really together with the St. John's, 2nd and Federal, St. Paul's and St. John's, and
mm-hmm.
then due to the difficulty of others getting across the river, they didn't have any bridges at that
no.
time.
And a very unreliable ferry.
And a very unreliable ferry. I'm going to get one of those up one second. Yeah, maybe I can. You know, I wrote this booklet, and then they were sold in St. Paul's, and I just bought a. For myself, I bought, I think, I don't know how many that I still have in store that I paid for myself, and I'll bet you if they knew I had them over here, they'd probably pay a good price for them.
Also noticed that in your book you mentioned that in about 1901 there were 850 souls and 228 voting members, and then in 1951 there were 353 voting members and 1,150 communicants. In both of the years, the figures show a rather large number of persons belonging to St. Paul's, but a small number of voting members. And I was wondering what constituted a voting member.
Well, there are three kinds of membership that are to come into play there. First of all, a membership which includes also the small children. I'd call it baptized membership.
Oh, I see.
Now, all of the number of souls would be the whole congregation, including children from a day old up. That would be souls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, communicant members are all those who have been confirmed and are going to communion.
Oh, I see.
Now, in addition to that, there is what we call voting membership, and according to the Constitution there, and according to the Corinthians passage, that is restricted to voting to men who, now they may say above 18 or above 21, mm-hmm. whatever they say, and they must be accepted in a, what you call a congregational meeting of voters and become voters, and so are able to carry on the business of congregation and hold office at the time.
Oh, I see. Would that be like a church council type?
No, it wouldn't be really church council, because the church council would be elected by the voters, and they would consist of, let's say, president, vice president, secretary, mm-hmm. trustees, a treasurer, trustees, and elders.
Oh, I see.
Financial secretaries. Those would be those officers which are elected by the voting membership to carry on the business of the congregation, which is resolved on, they would be the church council.
Oh, I see. But your voting member is the male of, say, over 18 or 21,
whatever
the church sets up.
Specify, yes.
Yeah, and they do the voting on matters of concerning of the running of the church.
That's right, and they also elect the officers of the church.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is it only male? Does that still persist today?
Yes,
or?
It does in St. Paul's, it does with us.
Just males?
Yeah.
No females?
No,
that's all right. I was just curious, as you said, male.
You know, we always refer to those passages there, and too, that it's quite interesting when you talk to them about those passages. The husband is the head of the wife, and so on.
Oh, that's absolute. Yeah. I won't argue that point at all.
So when I have my instruction classes and I explain these things and we read those Bible passages, and, you know, the women always kind of, I says, don't worry about that. I says, remember, the wife is the neck. The neck turns the head.
That's true. But today, women's liberation is prevalent, and, you know, they really scream out loud every time you say anything.
I know.
And
but, you know, I can't, I just cannot see this woman's lib from various standpoints.
And I bet I agree with every one of them, because I
first
can't
of
either.
All, first of all, there is this false, entirely false conception behind this woman lib, as though one or the other sex is being downgraded. I mean, certainly, yes, it says in the Bible, Adam was made first.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain order there, but it does not anywhere say in the Bible that the woman is inferior. There is in the Bible too this, that Eve was tempted, and then she tempted Adam. That there is a reminder of that's the way the fall came about in this, but otherwise, this. The Apostle Paul says that in Christ there's neither male nor female, neither Jew nor Gentile, but they are all one in Christ, so that as far as in the church and salvation is concerned, there is a declaration of absolute equality there. But at the same time, the Bible calls attention to the difference. Now, no matter what you do, the difference is there. There is a difference between men and women.
There has to be.
Well, there has to be, and you can't. Now, a woman has a certain sphere which God has assigned to her, and the man has a certain sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what they do, that's the way they're going to be. Unless they don't want to be what they are. And that, I think, is foolish. So, let's say, for instance, when it comes to the home, a taste in the home. Well, men have good taste too sometimes, but I think the woman has much more gifts there.
Generally speaking, I think she does.
And like in the church, well, we don't have women pastors, that because of the passage that says that a woman should not speak in the public, that means the congregation. But I much, much prefer, for our Sunday school, I much, much prefer women, especially for the little ones, because they have a better understanding. They know how to handle that better.
The little children. Right. They do.
Not that we don't have, we've got two men Sunday school teachers, and they work out good, but they'll do a good job, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
But for these little ones, I like
them. They identify better with a woman.
They'll identify better with a woman.
Yeah, it's like another mother image. And they're more familiar with the female, whereas the male is always, you know, their father's always at work.
And then the other thing is, there are some women that have great physical strength, but they are the exception. So equality. You know, you're going to always have a difference there. Who's going to have your cement sacks and the sugar sacks and run the bulldozers? Some women can do it. But in general, I think they can. You're always going to have it that the man will do that. And when it comes to war, which I wish wouldn't be at all, I don't know. It just isn't right. To me, it wasn't right to say, well, now the women all have to register and they have to go right out in the front lines, get shot.
They say that women would be far more sadistic about war than men are. They would be more persistent in going after the enemy and obtaining the information they want than what a man would be. I don't know how true it really is. I've heard reports on it before, that this is very, very possible.
I don't know. Would they want to do that?
I don't know. I wouldn't want to do that.
I don't think that, although I will say this, that I grew up in a rather, a tough community. And fights were frequent.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost had to do it to exist. But you'd get after each other with a fist. Maybe a good wrestling match, but that's the way it goes. It's different communities and are different. There was such a mixed population there.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt that, well, I was in the minority, see?
Mm-hmm.
Being a pastor's son, first of all.
That makes it worse.
That made it worse. And a German amongst French and English and Jew.
Oh, bad.
So, my sisters and myself would have to take a lot of guff. A lot of guff.
Right.
And, I don't know. I just, the Germans are very orderly people.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of them. But I got enough of it. And, anyway.
You want to talk
about? I took mine when school was out. just as before, I'd run and hide behind the first tree, and the fellows that maltreated my sisters or that I had anything out, when they came by, I had them separated, and I pounced on them. They got it one day after the other until the parents complained to the teacher. Well, I don't like it. It's a rough life. I had to walk home with the teacher for about a month, but I never got, they left everybody alone after that, and I was What was I starting out with? I was saying about the, when we got on to this here.
Women's liberation.
Yeah, women's liberation. Well, that kind of plays in it, whether it was there, because I saw to it that my sisters were protected.
You protected your sisters like any good man would.
That's the way it is.